This time on your weekly Constitutional.
So truth is in trouble these days. We don't know where to find it, we don't agree about what it is, and we're not sure what to do about it. This is a problem for politics, and it's a problem for daily life. I've written a book called Democracy and Truth, A Short History, that, in a short number of pages, tries to get to the bottom of this dilemma and explore how we got into the mess we are today, going all the way back into the 18th century to get to that point.
That was Sophia Rosenfeld, the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. Sophie's going to give us some perspective on the relationship between democracy and truth. Now, there's a timely issue. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's your weekly Constitutional.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Sometimes when I listen to what passes for political discourse in our nation, I'm reminded of an old Monty Python skit when Michael Palin goes into a room looking for an argument. Unfortunately for him, he encounters John Cleese.
Is this the right room for an argument?
I've told you once.
No, you haven't.
Yes, I have.
When?
Just now.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
I'm telling you, I did.
You did not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this a 5-minute argument or the full half hour?
Oh, just the 5-minute one.
Fine. Thank you. Anyway, I did.
You most certainly did not.
Now, let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
No, this isn't an argument.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. It's just contradiction.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is not.
It is. You just contradicted me.
No, I didn't.
Oh, you did.
No.
You did just then.
No, nonsense.
Oh, look, this is futile.
No, it isn't.
I came here for a good argument.
No, you didn't. You came here for an argument.
Well, an argument's not the same as contradiction.
Can be.
No, it can't. An argument's a connected series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. It isn't just contradiction.
Look, if I argue with you, I must take up a contrary position.
But it isn't just saying no, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Argument's an intellectual process. Contradiction is just the automatic gainsaying of anything the other person says.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
Not at all.
No, look.
Thank you.
But it's not all laughs and giggles. It's a very serious issue these days, and fortunately, I have with me a very serious person. Her name is Sophia Rosenfeld, and she studies truth and democracy. We spoke via Skype.
My name's Sophia Rosenfeld, and I teach history at the University of Pennsylvania.
Thanks for being with us today. Of course, our topic is your most recent book, I believe. It was just published late in 2018. What's the title of that book?
So the book came out this winter, and it's called Democracy and Truth, A Short History. And it is indeed a short history.
And indeed, it's a very timely topic. Why did you think that would be relevant today?
Yes. Well, I really wrote it not preparing to write it, in a sense, in that it came about precisely because it seemed so timely that we were having all these conversations about the status of truth and where it had seemed to go in this current political climate. And it sort of occurred to me that I'd been thinking about these questions both as a citizen reading the newspaper and as a historian for a lot of years. And this was the time to try to tackle what was the relationship between truth and democracy anyway.
Your thesis is that there's always been, I believe you call it, a vexed relationship between the two, democracy and truth.
Yes. I mean, I think we are in a particularly fraught moment. There's no doubt about it. But it also seemed to me that everything that's in the paper every day about the circulation of falsehoods coming from the top, coming from social media, wasn't entirely new. So it seemed worth exploring why truth has always been a problem, in a sense, for democracy, why disinformation and misinformation are kind of a perennial problem in democracies.
Well, you, like a true historian, you use a chronological organization for your book. So let's begin at the beginning. When does your book pick up?
My book doesn't tell the story of democracy from antiquity, because I don't think that's really the relevant story. The relevant story to me begins in the late 18th century, the time of the founding of the United States, time also of the French Revolution and a variety of revolutionary movements around the world that all come out of the Enlightenment. And so the problem in a nutshell is something like this. On the one hand, democracies are supposed to have a special relationship to truth. They're going to be rooted in true statements. They're going to produce truth. They're going to get rid of all the deceptions and falsehoods that are supposed to plague monarchies. But here's the hard part. Democracies are also not going to have any one authoritative source of truth. There's not going to be any one person or institution or even method that tells all the rest of us what's true. We're going to have to work it out for ourselves. And that means there's also always going to be conflict over what counts as true.
Yeah, that is a real problem, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, democracy is based upon some faith that there's going to be wisdom, you know, among the people, and that, mm-hmm. that wisdom will emerge through a process of open debate. And so you're saying that's not necessarily so?
Well, the idea is that in the best of circumstances, something like a loose consensus is going to emerge about some basic things. We're going to disagree about a lot, but we're going to agree about kind of what's good, what's dangerous, what's happened, some facts. Even if that's not kind of consensus on all the big questions, we're going to have some kind of minimal level of consensus on which to build policy and have our debates. The problem is, how do you even get to that minimal level of agreement? And that's where, especially right now, it seems like we're having a lot of trouble. One theory is that the people and experts will have a kind of back and forth, and that truth will emerge through a sort of the experts will tell us a few things. The rest of us will respond, and experts will correct what they say. And there'll be a kind of give and take that informally results in something like a consensus about certain things. The problem is when it doesn't happen. Climate change, for instance, might have been one of those things where you'd say, well, you know, there's disagreement about some of the particulars, but we're all basically agreed the planet's getting warmer and human actions have caused that fact.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to have worked that way.
No, it doesn't. And you say that problem's been around. I mean, were there experts 300-400 years ago?
That's a really good question. Not exactly like today. In some ways, two things have grown rapidly in the last 200 plus years. One is democracy itself. More and more people have a say. People who were once excluded from public life are included. But also the ranks of experts have grown exponentially. In early America, it was understood that there would be some people who would be more learned, what were often called more virtuous and more learned people, who might be elected representatives or might be in somewhat advisory roles to the government. But there weren't battalions of experts the way there are today, both inside and outside of government, from universities to think tanks to government agencies. All of that is really the growth of, been part of the growth of modern politics.
Well, to take one example then, the military profession has been around for a long time. And I guess 200 years ago, if the people of Britain were thinking of going to war with the people of France, they might very well turn to their generals and say, what do we need? How do we go about this? Is this even feasible? And so the experts, the generals and the admirals, would give their opinions, and then there would be a dialogue, and then there would be, as you say, a détente between the two groups, and then eventually a decision would be made. Is that the mechanism? Have I described it correctly?
That's pretty much right, exactly. I mean, not everything is subjected to popular decision-making. So, for instance, the public might weigh in an election year about whether the public is broadly supportive of a policy of going to war or not. But decisions about, say, which weapons to use when or military tactics, we tend to just leave to experts to work out. But the traditional idea is exactly what you've described, that there have always been experts that states need. For instance, as you say, a military has to have map makers, and it has to have people who know about ballistics, and it has to have experts in any number of aspects of what it means to go to war. But the problem becomes when the public ceases to believe that the experts really know something that's different or superior to ordinary people. And in some places, we might not have those doubts. But in a lot of parts of public life right now, there's a lot of doubt that the experts know best.
Yeah. Have there been examples of this earlier? I mean, were there times when the public's distrust of expertise was also evident?
So one interesting thing about American life is that starting really in the late 18th century, there's always been a strong impulse towards not being too deferential to people who position themselves as sort of social superiors. And that comes out of a rejection in many ways of British culture. And one shouldn't have to be sort of doffing one's hat to people of superior station. And that's one of the nicer kind of democratic impulses in American life. But it's also always brought with it a little bit of scorn of the educated person's pretense to superior knowledge. And that's really traceable from the late 18th century onwards. Already in the 19th century, somebody like Jackson was making fun of John Quincy Adams as a Harvard man, you know, so with all the pretensions that entails, as if he knew something superior by knowing foreign languages and having been this kind of rather cultured sort in a Boston
way. I'm so glad you
way.
Brought that up. John Quincy Adams, I think, is an enigma to most Americans these days, if they've even heard of him. But he was arguably the most qualified person to be president up to that point in American history. I mean, his parents had essentially trained him to become president. He'd been all over the world and he'd seen and done all sorts of interesting things. And he had an enormous educated mind and an extremely competent fellow. And he was up against, you know, the man of the people, the populist, Andrew Jackson. And the populist won significantly.
Exactly. And that was a really interesting turning point. That might be a good moment for thinking about, in comparison to today, the idea, right, that the public said, you know, we like better this guy who's promising us a little bit of common sense. That was one of his slogans. And in fact, you know, Jackson wasn't a man of the people either, any more than today's president. Donald Trump is really a man of the people in the sense that he was a very wealthy slave owner with a big plantation. But he positioned himself as the antithesis of just what you're describing, the Harvard elite guy with all the cultivation and the long political tradition in his family. And we've gone back and forth. There are presidents who fit both molds along the way. And there are good reasons. I don't want to sound like I'm always defending experts here. There are good reasons often to be suspicious of expert knowledge. There are also moments when experts have proved entirely wrong about things or ignored important information coming from other sources. But that tension between kind of popular instinct and don't tell me how to farm my land. I know better from doing it than you can tell me from your perch in some office somewhere, versus the sort of model you're describing with John Quincy Adams. There's a long tradition of that tension.
I've come to set the record straight. I've come to shine the light on you. Let me introduce myself. I am the cold heart.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And today my guest is Sophia Rosenfeld, the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about her new book, Democracy and Truth. It's Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And today I'm speaking via Skype with Sophia Rosenfeld of the University of Pennsylvania, all about her new book, Democracy and Truth, A Short History. There are a couple things going on here, it seems to me. One of them, as you say, is just the social status thing. You know, you're no better than me. You're not the boss of me. I don't have to listen to you just because you happen to have more money and were able to go off and study at some fancy college. So there's that hierarchical thing, or the resistance to hierarchy, that is, you know, very much embedded in the American tradition. And then there is the perhaps more legitimate notion that just because you call yourself an expert doesn't necessarily make you one. And you've got to prove to me that what you are saying really is a product of expertise that I should listen to. That seems to me to be more healthy skepticism.
So that's the thing. Skepticism is also a long part of the democratic tradition, and skepticism is a good thing. It means don't trust everything you hear, and it means sometimes look beneath the surface, and government needs to be exposed in full, and that means even its fact-producing parts. So, in a sense, experts need to be countered by skepticism. The problem is only when the skepticism is so deep that it suggests that anything experts say can only be biased information or another form of spin. You know, if the president says, I don't trust my own agencies, I don't trust the Congressional Budget Office or the National Institute of Health or any other major fact-finding organization to provide anything like objective data, then that's a problem because it suggests there can be no such thing, that all we ever have really is politics.
Yeah, let's go back in history again. Is there another example other than Jackson versus Adams where this came out in either American or, but it's primarily American history that you deal with, but are there other examples of this?
Yeah, sure. There are examples. I mean, I don't think this is unique to America. Mm-hmm. I think America might be a particularly acute case, but I think this runs through democracies as a whole. And that's one reason why we're seeing so much discussion of populism at the moment. But sometimes the tables are reversed. You could move all the way up to the 60s and 70s and say that in some ways, skepticism of experts was more likely to emerge on the left in the era of the Vietnam War, for instance, when the CIA, the New York Times, the major sources of information were more distrusted by people on the left who thought they weren't getting the whole story, that the experts were really in cahoots with the government to encourage a dangerous and highly problematic war. And that would give you quite a different story, but you might also be able to say that that's a story about the distrust of what counts as establishment sources of expertise.
They use the word establishment. From that era. And I also remember the slogan, don't trust anyone over 30.
There you go.
Which seemed very reasonable to me when I was 20. Now that I'm on the other side of it, I don't feel exactly the same way. Okay, so healthy skepticism. And in fact, Vietnam's a great example because there was a lot of lying and covering up going on during that time. And people who posed as experts were flat out lying about what was happening in Vietnam, hence the entire Daniel Ellsberg Pentagon Papers situation.
That's right. Yeah. So when people said fake news or the equivalent in that era, they sometimes said so with very good reason. And there was a lot of cover up. And that charge was more likely to come from the left. Today, it's more likely to come from the right.
So it's a tension, and it goes all the way back to what you said at the beginning, which is that we want to debate these issues. We want to believe in the wisdom of the crowd, but we also realize that we need experts and that, sadly, there's no one arbiter. In fact, one model that we have for this that I almost wish we could superimpose on society is the legal profession. I mean, we have a trial. And the purpose in a contested case, and the purpose of a trial is twofold. First of all, to come to some conclusion about what the facts are. And then secondly, to apply the law to those facts and reach a verdict. And in the first part of that inquiry,
yes,
when we're deciding what the facts are, we have something called, appropriately enough, expert witnesses. And
yes,
those experts, we don't simply take them on trust. They have to go through a specific process called qualification of the expert, where both sides get to question them. If I want to bring an expert in, I bring him in or her in and, you know, have them go through their resume and what they've done to prepare for this case. And then I ask the judge to approve this expert. And then, of course, my opponent goes up there and excoriates him and you know, criticizes his credentials or criticizes his methods. And, you know, the judge will then ultimately make a decision. But then another decision has to be made by the finder of fact. And let's, you know, it could be the judge or it could be a jury, as to whether to believe my expert who says A or the opposing party's expert who says B. I mean, that seems to me to be the closest one could get, not that I'm aware of, you know, rationally resolving these things through a rigorous process. But we don't have anything like that in the political realm, do we?
That's exactly right. I mean, it's one of the interesting things about how American democracy got established is that we created this very formal process with all kinds of rules for getting at the truth in a courtroom, but it doesn't work the same way in political life. It's that we have an entirely different set of procedures. The only interesting overlap, I think, is the idea that American law depends so much on juries, and juries are not as vital in every other legal system in the world. And I think that's partly related to this idea that it's important to have a kind of popular consensus, that the people get to weigh in, that the ultimate decision isn't always in the hands of those expert witnesses. The expert witnesses provide information, but in cases with, where there's a jury trial, it's really a jury of one's peers who are the ultimate arbiters as to what really happened.
And that's extremely important. As a historian, I know you know all about this, but that was very much part of our revolutionary spirit. One of the issues that we had was British judges imposing decisions on the colonials, and we insisted upon having our juries, and the juries represented the popular will and were a check, as you say, upon this elite judiciary. That seems to me to be the most formal striking of a balance of the sort that you're talking about that exists today. But it's a free-for-all out there in the political realm. There's no there's no qualification process for experts. I can go out tomorrow and say I'm an expert on climate change. And you know, people may believe me simply because I'm so good looking and I have such a smooth tongue, and especially if I can get myself on television or become a popular YouTube personality. And they might not look too clearly at the fact that my resume doesn't qualify me in the least to opine on that topic. So we have these so-called experts who are out there today, and the only qualification is whether they can convince enough people to believe that they're experts.
I think that's probably right. And also the number of places that you've just mentioned a few that you could offer your expert opinion have multiplied so incredibly in just recent years that we're almost deluged with information, and you can find any information you want. I mean, you could confirm your own biases very easily in the world of information out there. Insofar as there are no limits to being able to get out there anymore, there are no vetting processes even. You know, if you go online, you could, if you're good at it, you could spread your views as widely as you're able to, but nobody's going, there are no sort of checkpoints. They're not necessary. You don't need to be credentialed in a particular way. There aren't, publishing doesn't require the same kind of vetting. So this is great in a certain sense. It's a wild world out there. And information is democratized, but we're also inundated with it. And it's hard to know what to trust and what not to, especially as we're all rightly also a little bit skeptical that people often do have ulterior motives. They're working for companies with a vested interest in what gets said, or they have political leanings that cause them to frame their information in very particular ways. So I think we're all a little unsure what to do with the amount of expert information we have out there.
Yep. And we've lost one of our most important gatekeepers along the way, because in addition to the legal system and its particular procedures for presenting expert testimony, we did have one gatekeeper in the political process, and that was professional journalists. And I know that the history of American journalism has not always been pure, but there was, it seems to me, a brief shining moment in the mid to late 20th century when we had a relatively small number of media outlets. Three networks when I was growing up, plus PBS, and you know, a few radio commentators and networks. And for the most part, if you wanted to get on one of those places, you had to prove to the journalists who ran them that the journalist should be listening to you. If you wanted to be quoted in the New York Times, then, as now, presumably you had to have some sort of expertise, and the journalist's job was to make sure that you did. But we've seen a decline in professional journalism with this explosion of free information on the internet. Do you think that that's part of the problem?
Certainly the change in journalism that itself has been driven by changes in the economy and digitization have played an enormous role in changing the way even the idea we have of a marketplace of ideas has really changed. As you say, when anyone is a journalist, in some ways, that empowers everybody to get to the bottom of every story. But in other ways, it takes away any sense that there's really any place we can trust to provide us with the facts. And you point out there were once three networks, for instance. There were once a series of daily newspapers that were trusted in their hometowns. That's largely gone. You can turn for news to an outlet that appeals to your sensibilities. And many of the people writing for those outlets are not professional, or speaking on those outlets are not professional journalists. They're kind of spin masters, or they're PR people, or they're a variety of other, or just people with viewpoints in some cases. But certainly changes in the world of information, and especially in the online world have transformed the news business. The interesting thing, though, is that the early newspapers in America were not any more objective than, say, Fox News and The Nation magazine today. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were really entirely partisan journals. They were explicitly aligned with parties and particular positions. But by the late 19th century, the idea of objective news had emerged. The New York Times was one of the leading sources of that. And the idea was that there would be some distinction, that editorial pages would be different from the pages of reporting. What we're seeing now is some kind of breakdown again of that distinction, with the suggestion that it's almost impossible, that there's no such thing as neutral reporting in this particularly odd moment in American politics.
So in a way, we're returning to our roots when we have this highly politicized and to a great extent fragmented sources of information out there. In fact, you mentioned marketplace of ideas, Justice Holmes's famous phrase. I've sometimes wondered whether a marketplace of ideas can work when one person shops at Whole Foods and one person shops at Dollar General and never the twain meet.
That's a terrific image for this. I think that's right. So the idea of a marketplace of ideas suggested we were all in the same market. And if we were all in that same market, we would kind of collectively sort out what was the best deal out there or what made the most sense. If there's so much out there that nobody could take stock of what the available information is, which I think is true in the world of online communications. And if we start from such totally different social positions and cultural, intellectual, educational positions as a result, that we have very little kind of common ground for assessing the information that we do receive, and we are literally shopping, therefore, in two completely different kinds of marketplaces. I like your analogy very much.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored. You also mentioned the T word, trust.
Yes.
I've been thinking about this issue, as many, many people around the world have been thinking about this issue for the past several years. I wonder sometimes if that's really all it boils down to. I mean, we can't all be experts on everything. In fact, if we're lucky, we might have some expertise in one or two areas in our lives. So we have to rely upon somebody else, whether it's about climate science or whether it's about military affairs or whether it's about some other urgent matter out there. We have to rely on somebody else. And so essentially it boils down to, whom do you trust?
Right.
I don't know that I can take it beyond that, because I have to trust somebody. And I'm afraid that most of us choose whom we trust based upon whether they, as you say, confirm our pre-existing biases.
That seems to be the really important question here. So newspapers can fact check all they want, but if you don't trust the fact checkers any more than you trusted the original people who wrote the stories, the fact checking doesn't help persuade anybody. So as you say, if we lose trust in all the institutions and the methods used in those institutions to arrive at what seem to be incontrovertible evidence, then we're stuck in a world in which we can only know things through our own experience. And no one has wide enough experience in this complicated world to make those kinds of judgments. So, for instance, if I hear that the medical profession comes to the consensus that vaccination against measles is, for the risk of not vaccinating is much greater than the risk of vaccinating, all I can do really is assume that doctors know better than I do. I'm not a medical doctor. But if I decide that doctors don't know any better than me, and that I, or better than my friends, or better than an article I read somewhere online, then I don't have any solid ground on which to make any real decisions, I don't think. And no, of course, that doesn't mean that you take everything that you receive on face value. It's worth doing some digging. But there are places, for instance, on the safety of vaccines, where the medical establishment is overwhelmingly all on the same page. And I think we'd have to trust doctors at that point.
You have to. I mean, I don't know whom else to trust. I suppose there are alternate medicine people, and I don't mean to disparage all practitioners or believers in that, but simply that's your choice. I mean, either you believe in so-called Western medicine, which I refer to as scientific medicine, you trust in the scientific method, or you don't. And you've mentioned this area, we've talked about it on the show once or twice before, this anti-vaxxer movement, which seems to be very much like a denial of climate science. You know, simply against all the evidence, people are refusing to have their children vaccinated, and we're seeing the results of that now. We're seeing children being harmed because we're having these pockets of outbreaks of diseases that we thought we had conquered, and it all goes back to this lack of trust. Wow. I mean, if you're not even going to trust your medical doctors, is there anybody out there you'll trust?
I think that's really the key question. If you can't trust any kind of experts, how do you create a world in which there's certain kind of assumptions that we build policy on? It's not that people in the past necessarily always believed what scientists had to say. We can think of all kinds of controversies in the past. You can think of even the Scopes monkey trial and debates about Darwin in the 19th century, for instance. But the media tended to be dominated to a considerable degree in most of the 20th century by what might be called establishment voices. So in that sense, scientists, doctors, policy experts. And so the views on things like anti-vaccine people tended to be at the margins. But now all information can be gotten in all directions. And it's opened up a wonderful world of alternative ideas, for sure. But the downside would be, for instance, that it's much easier for people who would have once had very marginal ideas, say anti-vaccine ideas, to find each other, to find alternative sources of information, to form a community, to feel like they're not alone, to feel not marginalized, but consequently then to come to the conclusion that there's a large body of people out there who share their ideas, who can build a kind of alternative information universe.
You've hit it on the head. In fact, I was not upset, but a little bit disappointed when on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, an event that I personally remember, I watched it on television along with hundreds of millions of other people, there are people who claim it never happened. There were people like that ever since 1969 who claimed it never happened. But as you say, they were on the margins and to a great extent isolated because they were not going to get a lot of ink in a newspaper or a lot of time on a television station. But now they do, and now they're mutually reinforcing one another.
That's just about right, yes. So there were always people who've doubted every event in history ever happened. You have everything from Holocaust deniers to people who have crazy theories about the assassination of Kennedy. You know, people love conspiracies and hoaxes and things. So that's all been a flourishing area of American life and really life everywhere. I'm not sure people always necessarily even believe it, but sometimes it's even just fun to think about.
Well, what's better than going to a movie where there's some terrible conspiracy that the heroes have to unravel?
Yeah, that's part of, I mean, that's fun in a sense and entertainment. But it's much more central at the moment to American life. Hoaxes and conspiracies can spread in dangerous ways, and they have all over the globe, sometimes started by a rumor on, WhatsApp or Facebook or any of a variety of social media. And that's alarming that these rumors, because of the nature of technology and the way they work, and also the rules governing that technology, can spread so much easier. The second thing is that they're also often confirmed or at least sort of hinted at by people at the top of the food chain, which is to say, if the president says sort of, I've been hearing, or it seems like, or people tell me, that's not confirmed information. It suggests the possibility that conspiracies could be real. And I think we've traditionally looked to authorities to sort of dampen or put out the fires of rumors rather than encourage them.
Well, here in the summer of 2019, as we have suffered through one of the largest and worst heat waves in our national history, I was tempted to get a little bit concerned about it until I took comfort in the fact that, according to our president, it's just a massive Chinese hoax. So there's really nothing for us to worry about at all. So as you say, when it's at the top of the food chain, I mean, we're supposed to be able to trust in our president. And that is just completely contrary to the facts.
It leaves people at least confused, I think. So if things that should be facts are termed hoaxes, and things that should be described as hoaxes are sometimes described as what's actually happened, you might not believe it 100%, but you might not know just quite what to believe. It's all a little confusing. And the suggestion that, you know, I've been hearing or some people think, those kinds of expressions suggest that everything's really up for grabs. There really is not much that's factual out there that we can hang our hats on.
And then it also leads to this false equivalence. You'll hear people say, and this is one of the few things people can say to make me truly angry, is, well, they're all the same. It doesn't matter if you vote for a Democrat or a Republican. It just doesn't matter because they're all the same. They're all liars. You can't trust any of them. That is the ultimate consequence to a democratic form of government, is that people become disengaged and they no longer even care or think it's even possible to come to rational decisions.
I think that's right. I think one of the greatest dangers we face, one of them is extreme partisanship, but the other might be just purely apathy, giving up on the whole thing, thinking it's all just everything everybody says is as equally, you know, made up and spin as anything else. So why be invested in any of it? If fake news, if everything's fake news in every direction, then the hell with all of it.
Tell it to. Tell it to, girl, man. You know you got me going everything crazy that you want me to do. Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you got me? Tell it to, yeah.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm having a fascinating but frankly disturbing discussion with Sophia Rosenfeld of the University of Pennsylvania, who's written a new book called Democracy and Truth, A Short History. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Sophia Rosenfeld, who's written a book called Democracy and Truth, A Short History. We spoke recently via Skype. So much of the difficulties we faced are caused by technology, and technology is not slowing down. And by the way, you're doing a very good job, Sophie, of depressing the heck out of me.
But sorry about that.
Perfectly.
I'll try to be more uplifting in a moment.
Next time we got to talk about rainbows and unicorns. But
yeah, right. In
the meantime, I'm doubly concerned about something that's very much on the horizon now, the so-called deep fake videos that we can now discern if we're careful. I mean, that recent example of Nancy Pelosi's the alteration of a video designed to make her seem incoherent or even drunk. It was a relatively primitive attempt, and it was fairly easy for people to see once it was pointed out to them. But as that technology improves, I mean, you're going to be able to go back and change anything and make anyone say anything in a very realistic video. And that has implications for today's politics. And it also, it's straight out of 1984. I mean, you can go back and change history, at least as far back as history, you know, included videos, and people will believe it.
Deep fakes are going to complicate things a lot, for sure, because the Nancy Pelosi video was simply sped up or slowed down. It was, in a sense, just primitively altered. As you say, deep fakes are going to allow people to be doing, saying things that they never said and never did in completely convincing ways. You won't have to slow and down some existing tape. You can just make it up if you want to have any public figure suddenly making a Nazi salute in public, you can very convincingly do that. If you want them to then, you know, utter some Nazi expressions, you can do that too. That's already started to happen in some places. There are a lot of deep fakes circulated before the elections in Spain just this spring, for instance, and we'll probably see some in the next election cycle. That really is a new frontier. And the technology, there has to be two things have to happen. One, the technology to detect deep fakes has to improve quickly. But the other is that there has to be will to detect them. And that can't be, I don't think, simply a matter of encouraging, say, Facebook or Google or YouTube to look for them. There has to be some real penalty, I think, for allowing them to circulate.
Okay, now we're getting into some of your suggestions. And this is the rainbow and unicorn part. I want to hear from you how you're going to fix this all for us.
Oh dear, that's a big job. Historians are generally better at telling you what's happened than they are at telling you how to fix it.
Okay, that's no excuse. You're on the spot now. You have some suggestions in your book. What are they?
Well, my suggestions range from the very small to the pie in the sky. And that's because I think the small ones are important, but they won't fix that much. And the pie in the sky ones are very hard to affect, but they matter too. The small ones have to do with the importance of sticking with, as much as possible, veracity. And that means the importance of fact-checking, the importance of clarifying the record, even if it seems useless for the Washington Post to print out all the president's lies in the last year or something like that. I think it's important for history and for now, too, to keep doing that. At the next level, I'd say it's also important to shore up institutions, but also to keep those institutions open to the outside so they don't become kind of closed shops of expertise. But I mean places like universities where I work, libraries, research centers, elections, all of the mechanisms, courtrooms you mentioned, the importance of the institutions that are in the business of providing information, clarifying error, helping the public access information. I think all of those schools matter a lot, and it's important that we shore them up and don't give up on the idea that it's all the same, all information is equally good, nobody really needs to know anything. Libraries and schools and universities matter a lot in these instances.
You mentioned schools and libraries and universities. Obviously, they are repositories of knowledge and expertise, but they, of course, also have a direct educational function. Is that also part of the solution? Is just teaching our children to have a healthy skepticism, but also to understand that ultimately they're going to have to make a decision on whom to trust, and they need to make it well?
I think education is critical in this, absolutely, and an education that's really retooled for a world of things like deep fakes. How nobody naturally figures out what to trust and what not to. And that process has to develop. At the same time, students need to learn skepticism too, so that they learn how to advance truth, which always happens as a result of questioning old assumptions and rethinking things. So education is a critical component. But that said, I also think this comes back to the discussion earlier about a marketplace of ideas. There may be a realm here in which we also need to address the economics and the legal framework in which information circulates these days. And it may be that some of our assumptions about this marketplace model are really a little outdated, that we wrote our laws and imagined a public sphere not thinking about the existence of Google or Facebook. And they've changed the game enough as businesses and as technology that there may need to be some bigger fixes. In Europe, there's already much more exploration of the possibilities, a kind of what you might call a First Amendment absolutism in the U.S. makes us a little bit more restrained about wanting to do this. Also, how much can you regulate private businesses? But these are private businesses that have taken over an enormous public function. They're our public sphere. And we may have to think long and hard about whether we're going to live in this kind of wild west of information permanently, or whether we need to restrain it a little bit.
That's also very current, of course. Facebook and other social media platforms started out insisting that that's all they were, platforms, that they were not responsible for the content posted on them. And I'm sure that then to some extent that's been codified in the law. And I'm sure that's the position they'd rather be in. But then we see what's on there, and we see these terrorist videos, and we see hate speech, even though that's very difficult to define. We see anti-Semitic statements. We see all sorts of very objectionable material. And so the call goes out, go ahead and start self-regulating Facebook, or we'll do it for you. And so then they try, and they run into exactly the same problems the government runs into when it tries to regulate speech. Even though there's no constitutional implication because they're not government actors, it's the same basic problem. And then we see the reaction to it. And people on the right especially are claiming that when Facebook eliminates postings or a site for hate speech, that they're really regulating so-called conservative content. And so there's already pushback. So how do we address that?
Yeah, I don't want to make you depressed again, but it is a very difficult question. But just throwing up our hands and insisting, well, you know, they're just neutral platforms when they need to be, but they also provide a public function other times, it doesn't seem satisfactory in the sense that these are also companies that often profit off the spread of either disinformation or misinformation, by which I mean either just wrong material or out-and-out lies. And precisely because they're businesses, there must be ways, and I'm not speaking as a lawyer, but there must be ways to think about disincentivizing the spread of misinformation. So the way things get popular right now, algorithms exist to spread that which people want to see, not what that's what's true, but what's likely to get the most attention. And sometimes that actually means that something sensational and, you know, the equivalent of a deep fake rises to the top rather than getting pushed all the way down in the algorithm so it never really shows up in your feed. And just simply asking Facebook, say, to find, or YouTube, to find some solution to that problem seems to me unlikely as long as those companies stand to profit from the fact that a lot of misinformation is going to spread. So, and that's aside from the sort of political content. So there are problems around hate speech. That's one issue. And another is simply false information. Sometimes they overlap, but not always.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And so the regime would be some sort of regulation placed upon these social media behemoths that would require them to self-regulate. And if they didn't, then they would have to be penalized. And as you've commented, this runs straight into the First Amendment. And I'm speaking as someone who's not quite a First Amendment absolutist, but is very protective of it. Yes, me too. Yeah. And I'm kind of wondering, however, whether the First Amendment really was written in such a fundamentally different era that we might have to reinterpret it, at least on the margins, to address this. And I've struggled with this, and we've talked about it on the show, with regard specifically to hate speech, but maybe also with regard to information that is simply false. I mean, right now, the court has decided pretty much definitively that I have a First Amendment right to lie, as long as I'm not, you know, committing fraud or something as part of a crime. But if I want to tell you that I won the Medal of Honor back in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, then, which I didn't, by the way, as long as I'm not trying to gain some sort of financial advantage with that or cheat somebody out of his or her money, then I can say it all day long. I can buy myself a used Medal of Honor and in pawn shop someplace. I can fake one and I can wear it around and pretend to be a war hero. And that was actually the case that they decided just a few years back. But yeah, we'd have to change that. And we'd have to say that, at least in the context of social media, that spreading false information would be something that would subject one of these companies to some sort of penalty. That's a fundamental change in First Amendment law.
Well, it's interesting because there is, as you say, a really wide latitude for political speech. But say commercial speech is much more restricted. I can't go to try to sell you some product and say it cures cancer if it doesn't.
Right.
Right. So that I can't lie about commercial goods. In the political sphere, the latitude is wider. But it's not really true that speech is totally unregulated either, because there are all kinds of laws about what you can and can't say already. Commercial speech is one. I can't libel you. I can't say something awful about you in the public sphere that might damage your reputation.
Oh, people do that all the time.
True, unless it were actually true. But right. If it weren't true, I can't. And even when it comes to issues, there are some things that are considered so kind of publicly repugnant, you can't encourage or even advocate for them. You know, you can't publicly advocate for pedophilia, for instance, or something like that. Those are taboo. So there are ways in which we do regulate speech to a certain extent. But as you say, we rightly tend to err on the side of the widest latitude we can. But it is, I think, also important to keep in mind how much the landscape of speech has changed, and that almost all of the jurisprudence connected to the First Amendment was written for a world that didn't have this kind of incredible communications capacity we have now. And it wasn't global, and it didn't spread as quickly or as widely. It wasn't as open to everybody. The world has changed in some substantial ways, and I think politics reflects that these days. Whether or not we should just weather the storm in some way, or whether we need to really rethink our legal framework. I will leave that to the legal experts, but I don't think it should be off the table. I don't think just sort of screaming about the First Amendment will solve any of these problems.
All right. Anything else? Any other suggestions you want to make before we conclude today?
Well, let's see. I guess the only other thing I would say is that at the very largest scale, the one possibility is that we are living in such different worlds, financially, with income disparity and wealth disparity, and educationally, culturally, that it sometimes does seem like there are two Americas out there. And it may be hard to try to fix any of these questions of truth as long as we continue to seem to live in such different worlds and bubbles, in effect. So in some sense, we may not be able to solve the truth question until we tackle some of the underlying reasons why we see the world so differently, why two people living in the same geographic space have such different perceptions of who's out there and what they're doing and what's good and what's bad. And that pluralism is a great part of American life. But if there's simply no common foundation, it does make you wonder whether truth is just going to go, just turn into another aspect of politics.
Okay, so for your depress me again, you promised me you would say nicer things, but you didn't do it. So we're going to call this the end of the interview. But I am in all.
Okay, sorry to end on a blue note.
That's all right. But in all seriousness, very much appreciate your coming on and talking to us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me on your show. And despite the depressing conclusion, that was a fun conversation. Thank you. I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Sophia Rosenfeld, the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. What a fascinating discussion. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment. So tell the truth.